This is the On Humans podcast with your host, Ilari Mäkelä. And today's episode is about biology and equality. Now, it's pretty common to see these things as not exactly the best fit. Indeed, when we study other species, things like rank, hierarchy, male domination, these things come up over and over again. So here are two common conclusions. One is we're stuck with those things. And the other one is our biology doesn't really matter. We can just focus on what makes humans so remarkable, which is the diversity of human cultures. But what if we're missing something in that dichotomy? What if there is something to be learned about equality by studying biology itself? My guest today thinks so. Sarah Brosnan is a primatologist who you might not have heard of, but it's very likely that you might have seen a clip from one of her studies. This is a clip that variations of which have gone incredibly viral, each variation getting over 1 million views on YouTube. Long story short, there is a monkey who does a task, gets a cucumber, likes the cucumber, eats the cucumber, completely happy, sees that her friend does the same task and gets a much better reward, a grape. And upon receiving the second cucumber, throws it back at the experimenter. Now, for some reason, seeing this monkey reject unfair, unequal pay speaks to something very deep in us. It seems to gather attention just year after year after year. But why exactly? What exactly do monkeys throwing cucumbers have to do with human politics? It was really great to get to discuss this issue with Sarah Brosnan herself. But of course, we do move in this discussion much beyond just this one individual study. We talk about questions such as, what exactly is the role of equality versus hierarchy across primate species? Can monkeys learn more egalitarian social norms? And we touch upon many issues such as, what, if anything, sets humans apart in our ideas about fairness, about equality? Do property rights exist in the primate world? Are they just a human creation? We touch upon the question of, well, what about the monkey that gets the grape? Do they mind about the inequality, or are they very happy about it? And as always, we finish with my guest's reflection on our species. All of this builds something of a mosaic, kind of patchy approach to a very central theme of this very show, which is, how can we think about humans more firmly rooted into the animal world, but without succumbing to the kind of naive idea of the law of the jungle, where the dog eats dog, nature red in tooth and claw, etc., etc. And indeed, this was not only a very clarifying, somewhat enlightening, but also a really, really fun conversation. It has a particularly funny and a somewhat embarrassing start. You'll see soon. But a couple of things before we jump to the show. First of all, if you like what you hear here, but you do want to check some of the details, you would want to return to the argument or something at a later date, or if you just prefer reading to listening in the first place, you can now do so. So I run a Substack newsletter where you will be able to read breakdowns of each conversation. Currently, I'm publishing these a couple of days after the episode comes out. I hope to streamline the production one day, hopefully soon, so that they come out together. But you'll find the link to it in the show notes. You can now, for example, go and read the breakdown from the previous episode, 27, on whether human brains are special. And you can soon get a breakdown from this one too. Another thing is that if you like this show, please do show some support. Following, if you haven't followed yet, is a super easy way to do this. But if you're more serious, of course, you can also pledge some small support monthly via patreon.com. That really warms my heart and takes us all one step closer to making this show financially sustainable. Anyway, let's get back to the show. I hope that you enjoy this conversation with Sarah Brosnan. Professor Sarah Brosnan, welcome to On Humans.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So you have a wonderful TED Talk that I will link in the show notes, and I highly recommend to everyone. But you might be actually most famous in TED Talk space from a video where you are wearing a mask and it's quite difficult to recognize you. It's gone really incredibly viral.
It's actually not me in the video, by the way.
Yes,
that was a student I worked with. Okay. Sushak. Everybody thinks it's me, but it's not.
I did think it's you. I was certain that it's you.
She looks very much like me from behind. Yeah. She still does 20 years later, but it's actually Malini Sushak.
Okay. Well, that's both kind of funny and a little bit embarrassing.
Okay, well, I'll make an executive decision at some point whether I will actually use this beginning or change it. But
it is true, by the way. Everyone thinks it's me. We look really very much alike from behind.
It's so funny. That is really funny. There's very few people working in the space of primatology or psychology who have a video of their experiment gone quite as viral as you have. I'm talking, of course, about the video of the famous cucumber grape video. Why don't we start there? Would you like to, I'm sure you've done this many times, maybe start by quickly telling what happens in that video and why do you think that it keeps interesting people so much?
Well, it's a very evocative video. I can't tell you how many times one of my children's teachers has said to me, there's this great video you should go look at. And I was like, yes, I know it. But in the video, it's two female monkeys, one's named Lance and one's named Winter, who are from the same social group. And they're sitting side by side and one of them's trading and getting a grape. And the other one, Lance, is trading and getting a piece of cucumber. And what you see is that initially Lance is happy with her cucumber until she just sees Winter get one too many grapes. And when that happens, she gets frustrated. And in a beautiful example of aimed overhand throwing that would make an American baseball player proud, she pushes the cucumber out and hits the experimenter with it.
Yeah.
And then proceeds to do so again on the next trade.
Just it looks really frustrated. She's like clanging, like trying to like get to away and to the grapes, as far as I can tell.
I think she is. And in full disclosure, most of my monkeys cannot do aimed overhand throwing. Most of them just sort of do an underhanded push to get the cucumber out of there.
Okay.
But it's actually a fairly typical response. After enough times, and what enough is varies from monkey to monkey, and situation to situation, but after enough time seeing someone else get a better reward, they get frustrated and they start pitching cucumbers out or refusing to take cucumbers in the first place.
And as a background, of course, the cucumber is the thing that they're kind of semi-happy with if that's all they can get, but they would much rather get a grape.
Yep. And we can empirically test that. If I walk in and started handing those monkeys, and every monkey's food preferences vary, so we have to test every monkey. But those monkeys, if I walked in and started handing them pieces of cucumbers, they would happily eat them. If I give them a choice between a piece of cucumber and a grape, they're going to pick a grape either every time or nearly every time. They really like grapes. And so I think it is so popular on YouTube because I think most humans at some point, sometime have felt like Lance. They have been the one who just wanted to throw their grape back or throw their cucumber back out. And they probably couldn't because it was socially inappropriate, but they really wanted to. So I think it resonates.
Yeah, full disclosure. It's actually a standard terminology being for years in my relationship to throw cucumbers.
It's a good one. Yeah.
it's used maybe like 4 times a year. Somebody says, you know, I know this is, you know, I just feel like throwing my cucumbers now. And then we both know what it means, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that is why it is so evocative. I mean, she is just such an angry little monkey. I realize that I cannot get inside of her head. So I don't know that she is an angry little monkey. But what she looks like is an angry little monkey, and we all think we know what she's going through because we have all been in a situation where we're pretty sure we felt like that. And so I can explain to people what happened, and I can show people graphs of what all of the monkeys I've ever tested across the last 25 years have done, but nothing is quite as telling as just watching that little 2 minutes of video and seeing Lance's response.
Yeah. And I guess there's two things there that really interest people. I mean, it's not just the fact that, hey, I felt like that. Hey, I felt being treated unfairly. But also that this happens with someone from a different species. I think that's what really speaks to us, is that this is not just our silly, whatever social world of us humans. This is something deeper. And I guess that makes people feel heard in a way.
Yeah. And I think we get a lot of that as humans. You know, why do you care if someone else is getting more? Because you're getting enough. Why should you care if somebody else's salary is higher, if you're getting enough to pay your rent, or if you're getting enough for food?
That's why the cucumber is so interesting, because it was enough before the other one gets a grape.
And this suggests that it's not just that, oh, you know, you've been told that you should want as much as everyone else. This is not just a human thing. This is not just a cultural thing. This, I think, is a fairly deeply rooted biological thing. I don't expect to find it in every species. I haven't, in fact.
Yeah, where do you find it? Where do you find this?
Right now, and I mean, I'm a scientist. We put lots of caveats around everything we say.
Good. We love caveats.
Yeah, we have caveats make the world go round. But the right now, based on the data we've got, it seems to be in species that cooperate. There was an existing hypothesis out there from economics, actually, and also from psychology, that this response to inequity, this attention to inequity, was a way for individuals to know when their social partners, and in particular their cooperative partners, were taking advantage of them. So if you and I are working together and you keep taking more than me, you're probably not somebody I should be working with anymore. It's time to go look for a new partner. If you're in a large enough environment, there are lots of other partners and they vary in the degree to which they'll cooperate with me. Just by sampling the environment, I have a good chance of doing better with somebody new than with sticking with you. So all it takes is some ability to pay attention to your outcomes and my outcomes, which presumably any species that socially learns is already doing. Because in order to socially learn, I have to be aware that, oh, wait, you're doing something that I wish I could be doing, or you've got an outcome that I wish I could have. And lots of species socially learn. We know this.
But can you give an example of a species that doesn't have this response and an example of some other species that do have? We talked about, was it macaques so far?
Yeah, so if look in the primates, we haven't found it in orangutans, but we do see it in chimpanzees.
Okay.
But a big difference between orangutans and chimpanzees and bonobos, where it's also been seen, is that they aren't as intrinsically cooperative. So they spend more time on their own. They spend more time foraging for fruits and things like that that they don't need to work together to get them. And so they're certainly capable of cooperating. We know they will in the lab. And they're certainly capable of working together if you need them to. But it seems like they don't intrinsically do it as often.
That's really interesting, because it suggests that it's not that any smart animal, if you put them in a cooperative situation, they will rationally kind of calculate this wait, this is not a nice thing, I'm being taken advantage of. So this is not a kind of economic calculation going under the surface. This is something really deep.
I think it's an emotional reaction. I think they get frustrated. I think that the species that cooperate routinely, like capuchins and chimpanzees and bonobos, but not orangutans and not squirrel monkeys, for instance, have been selected to get frustrated when they get something different than a cooperative partner. And so they do. So it makes sense. I mean, the reactions that we see, they certainly look emotional. There are ways now that we can start to test that non-invasively. We can look at changes in hormones. There's starting to be some ways to non-invasively look at things like changes in nasal temperature. So hopefully we'll be able to answer that question fairly soon. But that would be my best guess. I don't think they're calculating. I don't think they're sitting there and saying, you know, I like cucumbers, but I like grapes more. And let me see, winter over there has gotten a whole bunch of them. So now it's my turn. And it doesn't seem to be every time. It's not like you get somebody else gets one thing that's better than you and you freak out, at least in these species, which also makes sense. Because if you're working with another individual, rarely are things going to be equal every single time. It is much more likely to be the sort of situation where you need to be looking over the long term. How do things even out over the long haul?
Yeah, what about then? I remember hearing that in species where both parents take care of the offspring, when you test the quote-unquote lovers together, they don't really mind either.
They haven't. And so I've tested owl monkeys and marmosets, and another lab, Julian Iworth's lab, has tested tamarins. Now, Aaron Musto has done some work and found some evidence that maybe they do respond in certain circumstances.
Okay.
But they don't all the time. And
by the way, are they always tested with their partner?
They're generally tested with their mated pair, because that tends to be how they're housed. And so most of us are testing them with the one they're housed with. And so my current working hypothesis, especially given that Aaron occasionally sees some of this, is that a lot of this is based on the fact, if this is about partner choice and you're in a biparental care species where you already have offspring in a very well-established pair bond, there may be a higher threshold to for responding and changing partners than there is in, say, a capuchin monkey, where changing partners is about who's going to be grooming you or helping you hunt for a squirrel, not necessarily, you know, raising your offspring. It's a much more costly situation. I'd really love to see how they respond in that initial period when they're choosing or establishing a pair bond, compared to how they are later on after they've already got an offspring and that pair bond is well established.
No, that is interesting. I mean, I guess because there is a perhaps complementary or perhaps alternative hypothesis would be that when you develop this kind of affection, attachment to another individual, without speculating too much about the emotional lives of pair bonding primates. But I could see that there is there's something else also going on, which is just that when you develop an attachment bond to someone else, you start seeing their wins as your wins on some level.
So that's another possibility. There's some evidence, and now I'm really going out on my speculative limb, but I'll go out there anyway.
Yeah, let's do it. That's why we're here. Yeah.
There's some evidence that individuals who are more close social partners are responding less strongly than those who are more distant social partners. This is not in pair-bonded species. This was actually in chimpanzees. I have been trying to test this for probably 2 decades. It's really hard to test. And the reason why it's really hard to test is because we only test voluntarily. So we only test those individuals who choose to come in and participate in our study because they want to. And so if you're testing a pair of them, they not only have to want to come in and test, but they have to want to come in and test with whoever you want them to come in and test with.
Yeah, so this is a problem with doing ethical research.
Yes. So what I've got is a ton of data in capuchins and chimpanzees showing that they want to come in and test with the individuals they spend the most time grooming with and sitting next to. So I have lots of data showing responses with their close social partners. I'm having an incredible amount of difficulty getting any data on how they respond with individuals who aren't close social partners. So we've tried everything from getting every possible dyad in the social group to come in. On the chimpanzee group, I think I averaged 54% of the dyads were willing to come in together, to trying to test with the entire social group present. And we gave them an hour so the dominants could get bored and wandered off. This paper isn't published yet. We're still working on it. But, you know, the subordinates were like, I'm not coming up with the dominant. So we don't really have data. So it's hard. I have intimations that they respond differently when they're with someone with another individual who isn't a close social partner. But there are two problems. First, I don't have any good data on it. And secondly, there also tend to be confounds with rank because individuals tend to be closer social partners with individuals who are closer to them in rank.
Okay.
So it's very difficult to tease apart the rank interaction from the social partner interaction. So I think you may be right. I think it may have something to do with the fact that once you've developed a strong social relationship, even if it's not a pair-bonded relationship, even if it's just a friend, yes, I may not see my closest friend's win as my win, but I'm still going to be happy for her in a way that I wouldn't with someone else necessarily. But testing that has turned out to be a bear.
Yeah, and just to be clear, I mean, an anecdote of one pair-bonding species of primates, which is humans, and my own experience, as I said, the throwing cucumbers is used in a pair-bonded relationship also. So it's not like it could never feel like that when you, even when you have a bond. So
yeah, if you ever have kids, you'll discover that gets used a lot.
Okay. but this is super interesting. I very quick question about rank, by the way, now that we are talking about themes around ideals such as equality. You've tested a huge variety of primate species. How universal, if we leave humans aside, because I think humans raise a lot of question marks in this, if we leave humans aside, how similar is this concept of rank across different primate species? Is it always pretty much the same? You know, you have the alpha, you have a few, you know, betas, and then you have, I mean, or is it that it varies completely? You have some species very highly hierarchical, some species less. How much variation is there?
There are some continuities and there are some differences, which really doesn't answer your question at all.
Well, it's a start. It's a beginning.
There are, In every species that I have worked with, even including the pair bonded species, although I'm gonna leave out the pair bonded species for right now, because often those groups are so small that it's really difficult to say much, at least in my experience. You really should ask someone who actually works with pair bonded species. I'm not the expert on them. But in the other species I've worked with, there's always an alpha, and especially an alpha male. And typically the alpha is the one who really makes most of the decisions in the group. How things rank below that and whether it is a relatively flat dominance hierarchy or whether it is a very steep dominance hierarchy or whether it is a dominance hierarchy where you see circularities or whether it is a very strict linear hierarchy and how important that hierarchy is varies quite a lot. We even see some variability within different groups within the same species. So rank is... You don't see, I mean, humans get complicated because they're different ranks for different things. Like you can have a different rank in your sports team than you do at work, than you do in your neighborhood organization. But even within the primates, there are some things that are difficult to get around, but rank may not be as, as set in stone as you might imagine. The other thing is a lot of it depends on the personality of the alpha male. So if you've got a cool laid back alpha male, things tend to be a lot more relaxed.
Okay, interesting. Now, one of the things that I wondered about is, for example, there is this really famous observation from Robert Sapolsky, where he studied baboons, where there was this kind of classic baboon situation, you know, a lot of beatings around dominance hierarchies, and then the really bad guys was it a toxic poisoning in one of the feeding?
It was a bovine tuberculosis outbreak.
Okay, yeah, which just happened to kill the. I mean, there was a logic to it why it killed the specifically the most dominant individuals, but the culture of the group just changed completely, right? And more when more baboons came to the group, they just accepted this new, very laid-back culture where, as far as I understood, rank and domination just wasn't quite so, at least, pronounced anymore.
Or at least the males didn't get away. Yeah, that was the Sapolsky and Scher paper from 2003, 2004. It's probably 20 years old now. Or Scher and Sapolsky. I can't remember which order, the author order it was. Yeah, the dominant males got killed because they were the ones who were able to invade the neighboring territory and get to the dumpster where the infected meat was.
Oh, yes.
I teach this paper in class. and it's fascinating. And there's another paper that's not as well known, but it was an empirical or an experimental study in the lab where Franz de Waal took a group of stump-tailed macaques and a group of rhesus macaques, and he had older stump-tailed macaques. And he put in younger rhesus macaques. They were 6 months younger. And so the stump-tailed macaques acted as sort of tutors to the rhesus macaques. And the rhesus macaques grew up much less aggressive. They had stump-tailed macaque behaviors. They didn't show the, because rhesus have much stricter dominance hierarchies and are much more aggressive. So it's not in either one of these cases that they got rid of the dominance hierarchies, but they just became much less aggressive and the dominance hierarchies flattened out a bit. Based on what I know about them. Both these studies I wasn't involved in, but it does suggest that there's a fair amount of malleability to these studies and that there's probably both cultural and environmental influences impacting how they form.
And you said you leave pair bonding species aside. I think for many, many of those who try to use primatology to understand humans, they are in some sense the most interesting ones. So what about pair bonding species? You said that the groups are so small that it's difficult to say anything, but what can you say?
Yeah, well, part of the problem is that I don't study them, so I'm not expert on those. So it's not that I don't think they're important, it's that they're not the ones where I have the expertise. When I was working with the owl monkeys, they were living in, I was looking at family groups. So it was a male and a female and their offspring. So the parents outranked the kids. And then you didn't see a whole lot of dominance interactions among the adults. And so it's just, they have dominance hierarchies, but when you've got a group that small, in my experience anyway, it was a less all-encompassing factor of their life. I mean, it didn't influence our results as much. Even with the capuchins, we often have to throw out rank because rank and sex are so heavily confounded because the alpha male is always the dominant one. So we often end up when we're doing our analyses with rank and sex being collinear. And so that becomes a real problem. So we only often look at rank if we're only looking at the females. And so I think one of the interesting things about humans is humans have these multiple overlapping relationships that are really important. So we've got the pair bonds, like the calotrichids and the owl monkeys and the gibbons. And we've got the close relationships among males, like you see in chimpanzees. And we've got the close relationships among females, like you see in capuchin monkeys and bonobos. And we've got the close relationships between males and females, like you see in baboons. So these are not pair bonded species, but you still see these friendships between male and female baboons. And so trying to figure out how we tie all these relationships together at the same time. So I don't think I would argue that there's no one species that is a sort of best model. And instead you really need to look at all of them.
No, that's fascinating. And it really suits actually I've never formulated a thought like that, but I have noticed that it is funny that almost any primate species, except maybe orangutans really never, but besides orangutans, I've seen almost every primate species being used as this is the best model for humans because this or that or this and that. And so, yeah, this is fascinating idea that we just weirdly combine so many of those traits that there isn't anyone.
And orangs, it's hard to know because there's been so much deforestation and recorded, even before recorded history, that we don't really know what they were like before they got so widely separated, because they just require such an enormous amount of food that they probably can't live together in groups. So it may not be a choice on their part. They certainly come together when they're masting events and they can come together.
Well, that's also an interesting kind of thing to keep in mind. I just recorded a long episode about chimpanzees and violence in chimpanzees, where this question of habitat loss became a pretty big theme. So it's something to keep kind of being a little bit concerned about how pristine is this natural environment where we get to study the animals in the modern world.
Yeah.
But just to stick to the question of dominance hierarchies just for one more question. In human studies, especially in hunter-gatherer studies, there is this idea of reverse dominance hierarchies that many, especially nomadic hunter-gatherers, are fiercely egalitarian, was the famous term, where there is not completely laid back, but there is no alpha, because if anybody tries to be alpha, it's, things get very serious and the group just drags them down, so to speak.
Yeah.
And now, leaving aside the questions of how pristine of an environment are these hunter-gatherers living in that we've studied, we don't need to go into that territory now of whether this is a universal amongst hunter-gatherers, but to the extent that this is something that accurately describes humans, is this unique? Is this something that we really don't see in any other primate, that you have this kind of group-enforced egalitarianism where anybody who tries to rise in dominance hierarchy is just dragged down, so to speak?
Chris Bohm has argued that we see it in chimpanzees too. There is some evidence in the wild, at least among chimpanzee males, that young chimpanzee males who are too uppity, or chimpanzee males who don't give up their dominance rank when it's time, you will see group attacks against them. And something that looks like it could be ostracism.
Okay.
Kicking them out of the group. I mean, clearly they have alphas. But there may be the beginnings of this idea of the group working to at least keep you in line. And we sometimes see evidence of what looks like that, even in captivity. I mean, Franz talks about a story. I don't remember which book he reports it in, but where there was a male who attacked a juvenile male for mating with a female. And the alpha male's attack was just too long and too aggressive for the severity of the transgression. And eventually the female started hooting at the alpha male.
Oh, yeah, I remember this story. I think it, that's fascinating. I think it might have been in Mama's Last Hug.
I think it might have too.
That's the one that I last read from him. And I remember this scene now that you describe it.
And so, that's an anecdote. And as people are fond of saying, the plural of anecdote isn't data. And yet, sometimes these are not things we can empirically test. I mean, even if we could, it would not be ethical to continue to put chimps in a situation or capuchins in a situation where there was a risk like that. So it's, you collect these anecdotes and see if maybe this, it gives us an idea of how these behaviors could have evolved. Maybe it doesn't happen very commonly. Maybe it is something that's really rare, but that would still be a situation in which we might see the origins of our own behavior. It had to come from somewhere.
Yeah, at least the origins of something that could result in a complete egalitarianism, fiercely enforced. In the TED talk by Franz de Waal, where I believe it's from there that this video originally is from, narrated by him, that then got viral. In that full TED talk towards the end, he mentions two interesting points. One is that, of course, seeing someone being really frustrated from getting less than others, it speaks to our notions of fairness and equality, yes, because they weren't bothered about getting a cucumber. They're only bothered about it when the other one gets something better.
Right.
But that it's still in some sense only the beginnings, because what we would really want from, you know, ethical ideals of fairness and equality
is the flip side.
Yeah, it's the one who getting the grape being like, hey, no, I don't deserve a grape. And De Waal just briefly mentions that there is some evidence for this second category of behavior, this rejection of me getting more, not wanting to get more than my friend, in chimpanzees at least. So this is a while back. Is the jury still out because he was a bit hesitant about it? Or is it clear that there is evidence now? Or what's the situation?
I mean, there's evidence. It's not clear. It is not clear how important of a factor it is. The evidence was from one of my papers. So we compared how chimpanzees responded in the same situation. They're sitting side by side, one gets a cucumber, one gets a grape. They clearly respond negatively when they're getting a cucumber and their partner's getting a grape. We also looked at how the one getting the grape responded when their partner got a cucumber versus when their partner also got a grape. The rationale being, if I'm more upset by my grape when you're getting a cucumber than I am by my grape when you're getting a grape as well, that suggests that I notice when I am advantaged. And we actually saw evidence of that. It was statistically significant and probably biologically relevant. The number of refusals, I think, about doubled. There are a few things to keep in mind. First is it was still swamped by the number of refusals of I refuse a cucumber because you got a grape. So they're much, 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 much more upset by getting disadvantaged than they are by getting advantaged. The second thing is that even if they are, we don't know why they're doing it. Are they doing it because they're worried that they're going to get beat up later? That would still mean they noticed being advantaged. So they're still noticing that they got more. The question is, are they responding because they're worried about their future outcomes, or are they doing it because they have this moral and ethical obligation for equality? Then again, I would say the same thing to humans. I mean, you know, if you find a $100 bill and no one sees you, are you more likely to turn it less likely to turn it in than if you find a $100 bill and you know you're being filmed on YouTube or something? I mean, then you're much more likely to do it because your reputation is on the line. So the other thing is, what we are measuring in these studies is when they are upset enough to refuse a food that they normally eat. That is actually a fairly high bar.
Yeah, because you can be annoyed and still be like, well, I'm still going to eat this crappy cucumber, but I'm annoyed.
I mean, I can think unequal salaries are unfair, and I can write letters to my Congress people and protest and go out and do the best I can, but still accept my salary, even if I know I'm getting more than somebody. And so that is a very high bar. And I'm aware of that. It's just, it also happens to be, you know, an objective way to measure whether or not they notice. So one of the things that we're interested in is looking for more subtle ways of measuring things. There has been some work, for instance, Friederike Ranga's group has done a lot of work with dogs and wolves, and they've added a measure of how much time the dog who's disadvantaged is willing to spend with their social partner and with the experimenter after they have been disadvantaged. So they're willing to accept everything, but they seem to be much less likely to spend time with the experimenter and the other dog. Again, you don't know why, but at least it suggests that they're noticing.
But by the way, that's an interesting point, because when you look at this famous video clip, it's not that what was the name of the one who got a cucumber and the one who got a
Lance
gets the cucumber. And
Winter's the other one.
Winter was the other one. Okay. So Lance and Winter. Yeah. So Lance looks pretty mad. But Lance doesn't look mad at Winter, who got the grape. Lance looks really mad at the experimenter.
Yeah.
And so the question also, like, yeah, are you mad at the person, at the agent responsible for the unequal distribution, or are you mad at the one who gets more, which is more kind of, I guess, could be said to be just envy?
Yes.
Is an interesting distinction. So is there any evidence on which one is it more? So that, because again, that's just one anecdote of me watching a video. And
well, and it's not something we can discriminate at this point.
Okay. Okay.
You know, there have been some people who've tried to do that by having the food handed out by machines and things like that. That's a little tricky because they're used to getting, I mean, our guys are computer trained, so they're used to doing joystick tasks and getting fed. And if I'm doing one task and you're doing an easier task, you're going to get fed more often than me, but it's not a comparison. And so they're so used to that, it actually becomes a little tricky to measure that.
Okay. But from the dogs, where if you, with dogs and wolves, you check how upset or how much time they want to spend, is it so that it's the same effect towards the experimenter and the other?
I don't remember.
Okay.
But I know they measured both because they were interested in who they were upset with. Were they upset with their partner or were they upset with the experimenter?
And do you happen to remember the paper? Maybe I can link it in the show notes.
No, but it's Frederica Ranga's stuff and I can dig it up for you. I can always send it to you later.
Yeah, let's return to it after the conversation. But that's fascinating. Yeah, really, really interesting.
One of the things that we are trying to do now is also come up with more subtle measures that are also objective. I mean, what I don't want, it would be very easy in something like this where it's such a human thing to easily fall into the trap of seeing what you want to see. So we want things that, I mean, either they threw the cucumber out or they didn't. I mean, that one is really easy to be objective about, but I think that could be the other thing. It's very possible that they're noticing when they're getting advantage, but if it's hard to get rid of a cucumber when your partner gets a grape, think how hard it is to get rid of a grape when your partner gets whatever, because they really like grapes.
Have there been any ones where they have the capacity to share?
So yes, that's an interesting point. So there's been a decent amount of research that has looked at how inequity influences cooperation. So if I put you in, say, a classic bar pull study where two individuals have to work together to pull in a counterweighted tray, and if they do so, they both get food. But if they don't work together, then nobody gets anything. What we find is that they do fine for inequality until you reach points where inequality becomes too much of an issue. So for instance, there's a really nice study that Franz de Waal and Jason Davis did, where the monkeys were pulling in the tray, but instead of the foods being right in front of where you pulled in, so like you pull in and you grab your food and you're off and running, the foods were still in their separate cups, but they were clumped together in the middle. So you and I pull in our food, but then we've got to walk to the middle and figure out who gets what. Food's already divided up. It's already in separate cups, but they're sitting right there next to each other. And from the get-go, the monkeys were like, no, not doing this one. Now, these are socially housed monkeys being tested with social partners from their social group, most of whom have grown up in this social group. So they know these other monkeys really well. And they took one look at that and from the first trial, refused to participate much more frequently, like half as often when the foods were clumped as than when they were spread out. Which the obvious interpretation is they recognized that it was going to be very difficult to negotiate who got what food, or one of them recognized that they were unlikely to get anything. So they refused to participate.
I earlier said that there are two points that de Waal raises towards the end of the TED Talk. We have touched upon one, which is the question of what about when I get more? I want to promise that I will return to the second point soon. But just to stay here for one moment, there's a huge literature coming, especially from the work of Michael Tomasello and Felix Warnecken on these kind of tasks, comparing chimpanzees and human children, where you have to pull ropes. And if I remember correctly, the basic take-home message is that young children and chimps are completely fine if they pull their own ropes and they get their own foods. They're pretty fine doing the task. And they're pretty fine with inequality. So if young children, if I remember correctly, when young children pull separate ropes, it's relatively fine for them. If they get more than the other one, they might keep more than the other one. But if they pull the same rope, if it's a joint task, if it's a cooperative task, then it is the most automatic thing for most children to do, to share whatever they get, even if it comes so that it's unequally distributed. And if one doesn't, importantly, the typical response is verbal. You shouldn't do that. They link this to the origins of moral language, which makes it just really fascinating. But I remember that this is where the big contrast to chimpanzees were, that if chimps pull the same rope and they get different amounts, well, either they just stick to different amounts or the dominant individual grabs it all. And therefore, the other one doesn't want to cooperate in the next round. Whereas in humans, they just keep pulling the rope and getting more and sharing and pulling the rope and getting more and sharing. That's the kind of, that's the basic picture as far as I remember it. And so you would basically agree with their results suggesting that chimps don't really end up sharing. They don't do the kind of, because we pulled the rope, if one of us gets more than the other one, where like one of us gets three bananas, the other one one, the one who gets three would give one to the other one. That doesn't really happen with chimpanzees, but it happens with human children, was I think their main finding. Is would you agree with that broadly?
Yeah, yes and yes. I like their studies. I also think it's probably context dependent.
Okay.
So we did a study at one point that was sort of similar to that. It was sort of an ultimatum game-esque study. It was a limited form ultimatum game where chimpanzees could choose from between two tokens, and one was an even split of two bananas. You both get three pieces, and one was an uneven split. I get five and you get one. And if they were just choosing, they always chose the one that benefited them, which is right in line with those results. However, if they knew they had to pass the token to their partner and their partner could then refuse to pass it out to the experimenter, they were much more likely to choose the even split. Now, nobody ever actually didn't pass it out to the human experimenter, but we replicated this in kids, and kids showed the same behavior and also never refused to pass it out to the experimenter. But kids used language. Kids said things like, hey, why did you pick that one? You should have picked the other one, and we'd have gotten the same. We used stickers for them.
So there the human and the chimpanzee pattern were more similar than in the Tomasello ones, okay?
So I'm wondering, I think that humans do share in a broader variety of circumstances and probably cooperate in a broader variety of circumstances. I wonder how much social pressure plays a role in that. So if the humans or the kids think that there's someone watching, or they think that that's what they're supposed to do, there may be a more strong instinct of if we work together.
Yeah, because that's exactly, I think, the red line in Tomasello's thinking around this, is that what is the origin of human morality? Like, what's really special and not just built on top of the things that everybody else is doing in the primate world is this idea that if we do something together, we become interchangeable, we become equal in a very fundamental way, which we don't see anywhere else. So it's really that pulling the rope together that, for his thinking at least, seems to change everything, and suddenly it's almost the most natural thing. Of course we share this because we did it together. And I think that he would really agree with your caveat towards the end that yes, but it's a bit different with this sticker game where you're not really doing anything together.
Well, and also the other big thing with humans, at least humans above a certain age, and you know, we've argued this before, is humans can think about how their actions are going to influence others in a way that chimpanzees can't. So even if I'm a human who, you know, you've got, let's say you have a sociopath or something who doesn't necessarily have any of these instinctive understandings of how it works, or let's say you've got a normal human being who sees a chance to benefit, is tired and doesn't feel like cooperating, really particularly likes whatever it is that is coming in, whatever it is. We can think about how our actions are going to influence our partner's behavior in the future, think about the future, plan ahead. We know that our actions today, I mean, people will explicitly say, I didn't really want to do this, but I knew I might need so-and-so's help in the future, so I decided to help anyway.
No, that's a great point. And I think that there's kind of two sides to that. So I think the most famous thought experiment around this is the Ring of Gyges from Plato's Republic, where Glaucon wants Socrates to explain why there is anything else to justice than the fact that you're not going to succeed if you cheat on everyone. And the thought experiment there is that if you have this invisibility ring, well, then you would cheat on everyone and you would, you know, become the king and get, I mean, in this story, it's this guy, the shepherd, who finds the ring and becomes the king and gets the king's wife. And classic Greek story. But the basic idea there is that I've always felt like, well, I don't think that we would all become brutes the second we don't have any reputational damage from it, because that would suggest that we literally have zero sympathy, zero compassion, zero guilt, any of these things internalized, which is to suggest that we would all be stone psychopaths or whatever, which I don't think the evidence supports. But then on the other side of the coin, it's like, well, even if we were, there are all of those things that all of these reputational issues. So even from a purely unsympathetic, uncompassionate point of view, given that we don't have invisibility rings, it often does pay off to cooperate. So it kind of has like a double take-home message for me.
Yeah, and we have grown up with the assumption that you're being watched all the time. So I think that we don't even know how we would react if we weren't. You know, I watch all these debates about what goes on social media, and people, when they think they're anonymous, you know, they say and do things that I'm sure they wouldn't do in their regular lives. You know, not everybody does, though.
Yeah, not everybody does. But hey, maybe actually now that I mentioned Tomasello, it would be good to also go to that second point that I promised to return to. So the other point Dewal makes in the TED Talk is to say that there are people who say that this is nothing to do with fairness, nothing to do with the social comparison. It's just the fact that when they realize that there are grapes available, they get really mad at the experimenter for not giving those that better outcome. And if I read the literature correctly, Tomasello makes this exact point. And here the literature gets very dense. I mean, I've checked all there's a lot of relevant papers, and they all have a little bit of a different experimental paradigm. What Dewal says is that, no, we've done all the appropriate conditions. It's definitely about social comparison, about fairness. It's not about this other kind of expectation. Tomasello says the opposite, and I have no idea what to believe. I know that you're not the most unbiased observer of this debate, because
of course not at all.
Yeah, but can you help me? Maybe you can walk me through the way you see this disagreement, and if there is any kind of consensus now or in near future around it.
Yeah, I think there's growing to be more of a consensus because there have been enough studies on it now. So the question at hand is, is Lance responding to that cucumber badly because all of a sudden she sees grapes out there and she wants the grapes too, which would be the equivalent of me finding out that, you know, I've been getting Hershey Kisses and, oh my goodness, there's Ghirardelli chocolate out there, so why am I working for Hershey's? Or is it that she sees Winter getting it and now she wants it too, which is the equivalent of me being happy getting Hershey's Kiss when everybody else is getting one. But if you start giving everybody else Ghirardelli squares, I want a Ghirardelli square too.
Which is more about fairness, equality, these kind of norms.
Yeah. And it doesn't even necessarily have to be about fairness or equality. I mean, it's really about social comparison versus individual comparison, which was a foundation to fairness or equality. But I mean, what you see Lance doing isn't technically about fairness, because as you pointed out earlier, fairness is about both sides of the coin. If I only notice when I'm getting treated unfairly, that doesn't necessarily make me a very nice or a very fair person. That just makes me someone who's only looking out for me. So if we're using the term colloquially, or in philosophy or economics, what we're assuming is that it is someone who is paying attention to distributions and wants relatively even distributions, whether that is equal distributions or distributions that are equitable to effort or whatever it is, it's still an assumption that it's not just self-centered, but about the group, whatever the group is. And that's not what we're seeing here. What we're seeing is her reacting in a very self-focused way. But inequity has to start somewhere. And so I think it is much easier, and I've argued that I think it is much easier to see a pathway for the evolution of the sense of fairness that starts with, ooh, I notice when I'm getting less than you and I really don't like it, which is an obvious benefit. And then from there, it can evolve to, oh, now I notice when I'm getting more than you, which actually is also a benefit, but it's a little bit further down the road. It's a benefit to me to withhold my behavior when I'm doing something that's going to ruin our cooperative relationship, but the benefit comes a little bit in the future. So it's not unreasonable to think that some of these fairly cognitive species like chimpanzees, like dolphins, dolphins, like, I mean, even potentially dogs and capuchin monkeys, although I've seen no evidence of it in capuchins, could be showing some of the sort of rudimentary beginnings of that second stage. But humans are clearly very good at it. So not only do we pay attention to that, but we're thinking way in advance. So back to the response. The question was, are they just responding to the fact that there's something out there, or are they responding to that actual social comparison? So the way we typically test that is we run a study where we run something that's very similar to what you see in that video where Lance and Winter are side by side. But in this case, we have the two little cups of food. And every time Winter trades, we wave a grape in her face and then put it back down and make her trade for a cucumber and then do the same for Lance. So prior to every trade, we are drawing their attention to the higher value food, but they are both trading and getting the lower value one, which is not only drawing their attention to it, but also the social comparison equalizes. There may be grapes there, but nobody's getting them. We don't get as strong responses for that. As a matter of fact, in capuchin monkeys, we really don't get a response at all. And in chimpanzees, we do occasionally get responses for what we call contrast effects. That would be the individual comparison.
So basically, just to be clear, you don't get any effects from waving the grape in front of them and then giving a cucumber. You only get it if you give the cucumber to their mate, but not their friend, their buddy.
Yes.
But not them. Okay.
Yes.
And I mean, this might get really deep into the weeds. Let's not spend too much time here. But even in, you know, Natural History of Human Morality, it's a great book by Mike Tomasello, 2016, mm-hmm. if I remember right. It explicitly says that chimpanzees don't seem to have this kind of reaction to inequity when you run the appropriate controls. So what is the disagreement then? Because it sounds pretty case closed based on your description.
You know, I don't know. I haven't talked to Mike in a while. I'm not sure that he would necessarily, I think he would still argue that there's a huge gulf between chimpanzees and humans.
Okay.
At the time he wrote that, and I mean, it was published in 2016, so it would have been, the manuscript would have been finalized in 2015. There still wasn't a whole lot of data out there on chimps. So I had published a paper in 2005 and 2010. One came out in 2015, but I don't know if it was out by the time he wrote that book.
Yeah, I see.
Joseph Call had published a couple of papers and they hadn't found it. One of them, they didn't do a task. And since then, I mean, there are a bunch of things that it turns out make a difference. So if you only run a few trials, they don't tend to refuse. So my tasks with the chimpanzees, we were running 25 or 30. Theirs, they were running 5 or 6. And I think it's because they're not responding to every single situation. They're responding, it builds up over time, like we mentioned earlier. And if you look at mine, we actually were able to get enough trials to do an analysis. They are more statistically more likely to respond at the end of a session than at the beginning. So it's not necessarily surprising that they didn't find a result with only 6 trials. Chimpanzee testing is tricky because you can only test them in an enclosure that you have. I mean, you can't just pick them up and move them around like you can with, say, a rat or a goldfish. So the way their test boxes are set up, the chimps are across from one another and mine are side by side sharing an enclosure. And we know in humans that makes a huge difference. If you are sitting next to someone, it evokes this shared sort of, we're doing this together. Whereas if you're sitting across from someone, it's more of a competitive sort of situation. So they were across one another in a 1 meter wide test box, whereas mine were literally sharing an enclosure and sitting shoulder to shoulder. And so I suspect that that made a big difference as well. I don't know if they have retested their chimps since then, but we've run several other studies continuing to get the same responses. And I know they have retested their bonobos and found that they do get a response to inequity after all in the bonobos.
Super interesting. I mean, this is one of the reasons I love being able to have these conversations, is that just trying to find all of these details by reading all the articles would have taken months, and probably I would have given up before the end.
Yeah. And I mean, that's one of the reasons why science is so much fun, because it keeps moving forward and people keep talking, and I know it's cool, because you say, oh, well, you know, we thought we came up with this cool new idea. Let's test this one. And you know, I wouldn't disagree. I mean, obviously there's a difference between humans and chimpanzees. So I wouldn't disagree. And I certainly wouldn't disagree with the fact that that humans are much more responsive to when we get more benefited. Like I said, chimpanzees maybe have a taste of it, but they were much more responsive to getting less.
I mean, us, honestly, us probably humans would be too more. I mean, it's a much more emotional feeling of egalitarianism that comes from the oppressed rather than the
oh,
people
yes.
at the top who are like, oh yeah, this is actually a bit unfair. it's wonderful that there is anything at the top, but it's not quite as throwing your cucumbers.
I've always thought it was astonishing that anybody argued they should be the same at all.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think the evidence is that yes, there is something special about seeing your partner get that better reward.
You've suggested several times that fairness, equal distribution, paying attention to these things, caring about these things, it's good for cooperation. Can you make that case to a skeptic?
Yes. So you can cooperate without these things, particularly in a situation like coordination where, or byproduct mutualism, where I am cooperating because it benefits me, and however it benefits you is irrelevant to me. So it's whatever you get, I'm going to keep cooperating one way or the other because it doesn't really matter to me. I either need to keep doing this or it still benefits me enough to keep doing this. So in that case, I wouldn't expect to see any effect of unequal outcomes.
So if two people are rowing a boat, even if one of them doesn't row, well, it's still better for you to row than to stop because you're still just going to get that much faster to the end point.
Yeah. Now, you might not choose that person to row with again.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it's also not about, with humans in particular, it's not about, and this is where humans get trickier. It's not about competence. This is strictly about what, you know, if you're not as capable as I am, I mean, if you're rowing with a six-year-old, you're going to have an expectation that you're going to work harder than if you're rowing with a friend of yours who gets out there and decides he has a little blister and isn't going to do anything, and you're going to get irritated. But where you would expect to see this make a difference is when two individuals are cooperating on a task where it is to their advantage to work together, but not necessary. And so it's going to be particularly problematic for one of them if the other one gets quite a bit more. So for instance, if you are hunting for something like meat and you're a chimpanzee, meat is not necessary for their diet. So they're doing it for other reasons, for social reasons, maybe for micronutrients. There are a lot of hypotheses out there, but none of them are because they need it. They actually only hunt when they are much more likely to hunt when they have plenty of food in the environment. Or you're going to be making a play for, in Capuchins, I think it probably plays a role in coalitions and alliances. So two males who are making a play for being higher ranking. In that case, first of all, it's not necessarily essential. You could wait and do it later. But the other thing is that's a context where if I don't trust you, if you're going to take advantage of me, then it's going to be really detrimental to me because you're going to take advantage of me and suddenly be much higher ranking than me. And I helped you get there. So if I am deciding with whom I'm going to form a coalition and you consistently are taking more than your fair share, or I'm hunting for meat and you're consistently taking more than your fair share, once or twice, maybe it's just the way these things go. But after several times, it may be time for me to go find a new partner.
The problem, I guess, there is that there is a way to read it as deep inequalities. If we now, bring it back to the human world a little bit, having massive inequalities will make people not necessarily be super keen to shake hands and do this thing and put a lot of effort in doing it together, especially in certain kind of tasks. But then it's not obvious what, as you've hinted before, it's not obvious what it means to be equal. Because on the one hand, I mean, is it the equality of opportunity or the equality of outcome? And I think that what comes really interesting here is that if we were to try to create full equality by just taking from those who have more and giving to those who have less, well, there is also a problem there, right? Which is that property rights, the idea that this is mine, I have earned this and this is mine, is also something that seems to be pretty rooted in our primate nature. Could you give some examples of how you come to the conclusion that you have come, that there is something like property in the minds of other primates?
Yeah. I don't think they have property. I think they have possession, possession norms, because they don't seem to have any sense of something that is mine when I am no longer in possession of it. Possession usually means like physical possession. I am holding on to it. Occasionally, it may be a little bit more distant. And this varies by species. So there seems to be a socio-ecological norm to it. So capuchin monkeys, once they have a food, even if they're fairly low ranking, they usually don't get it taken from them. Same is true of chimpanzees. So if a juvenile manages to get a food, they can usually hold on to it. They may be stalked with somebody just sitting there staring at them, but they're not going to have their food physically taken away from them. The same is not true for rhesus monkeys, where their food can be taken away from them.
So in rhesus monkeys, there are no possession rights. In a lot of other primates, there are some possession rights. So the alphas won't just grab...
Capuchins and chimpanzees, there are notably some possession rights.
Capuchins and chimpanzees, some possession rights. Okay. Some possession rights that the highly dominant individuals respect.
Yes. And I mean, that is part of what happens with possession and property. And part of why I think they don't have property. Possession only works if the ones who have the ability to take away don't. Or if you have some sort of powerful central authority who can control individuals who try to take away or to whom you can go for redress. So if I am a chimpanzee and you watch somebody steal my banana, you might come help me get it back. We see that.
Okay.
But if someone steals my banana when no one is watching, there's no way for me to go tell anybody because they don't have language.
But the former does happen.
Yes.
Fascinating.
So it is... That makes any form of property very difficult because any form of third-party maintenance of property rights is going to be nearly impossible because they have sophisticated communication systems, but they cannot communicate about missing or stolen property outside of the here and now. And what we do see, though, is we see some of the psychological factors that you would expect to see related to property rights, like they have endowment effects. So they tend to value something that they've got in their possession more than they value something that they could trade it for.
So the endowment effect is this, have I gotten it right, that it's this irrational way in which humans and some other primates like chimpanzees value the thing that they own just because they own it? So that oranges or apples, if you give me an apple, I really want to keep the apple and think apples are good. If you give me the orange, I'm going to say, oranges are better. I don't want to trade it for an apple.
And I actually don't think it's terribly irrational. I mean, if you live outside of a system where you've got third-party property rights, it makes no sense to be trading something you've got unless it is for something that is much better. So if you like oranges a little bit better than apples and someone gives you an apple, it's probably not worth the risk to trade it for that orange, because if they take both, it's not worth it. Whereas if you like grapes a lot better and someone gives you an apple, it might be worth the risk to try trading for some grapes because you like grapes so much more. So that's going to come across looking like an endowment effect. But what I think it actually is a rational response to when you have something in your possession, it should be worth more because now you have possession of it. And that's irrespective of any sentimental value or learning more about it or anything like that.
And that's the problem with redistributive fairness, I believe, would stem kind of from the conflict of these two impulses, where there is the one impulse of wanting to have at least broadly similar amounts of something. But on the other hand, you don't want definitely some stuff to just be taken away and, taxes theft or whatever. And I guess there is a kind of way of seeing a lot of difficult choices that equality-based ideologies have to make in the kind of conflict between those two approaches.
I don't think you're ever going to get people agreeing on this. I mean, I cannot see a way because, I have my preferences, but whether you're focused on equality or whether you're focused on equity, and even if you're focused on one of those, they're different definitions.
Exactly.
Said, I mean, even equality broadly, is it equality of opportunity or equality of outcome?
Yeah, and anybody who speaks about equality of opportunity, if they will be really serious about what they mean and understand what poverty does to childhood opportunity, it gets pretty difficult.
It does.
To then just say that, well, as long as we just, just go on. Run the race. So it's very slippery and very difficult to
It is extremely difficult. And I think, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be completely equal in the sense that if you say, you know, this job requires you to work 80 hours a week, if you choose it, we will pay you more. This job only requires you to work 40 hours a week, so we won't pay you as much. Or this job requires more training. I think most people would be cool with that. Because that's a level of equality that makes, that is a rational equality. But that, you know, that when you've got people making thousands and thousands of times more than other employees in the same company, that's, I think, when you, people don't see the rationality of that.
Yeah, yeah. No, I had a really nice conversation about this with philosopher Elizabeth Anderson. And it's not like, you know, I think that it's not like now suddenly I know all the answers to these questions, but she had a pretty nice way to think about it. Towards the end of our conversation, she said that it shouldn't be about kind of let's envy those who have more and pity those who have less. It should be about making sure that everybody can participate as genuinely equal members in a democratic society. And if that happens, we should be fine with this kind of, you know, you work a bit more, you get a bit more. But it's when the things that we value, and of course, this is a bit subjective, what do we value as being able to function as democratic citizens? But once we have those things guaranteed after that level, it becomes more of the kind of acceptable different input, different output. And I think that, yeah, it's been something that I've thought about a lot and something that I think is at least not completely off the rails when it comes to clarifying my own thinking. But I don't know, does it raise any thoughts when I say?
Well, I mean, I don't study humans, obviously, but I have thought about a lot about it because it's obviously relevant. And it doesn't surprise me in the least that people get upset about inequality. I get irritated when I read, you know, reports where people are like, I don't understand why these people are protesting. I understand why they're protesting. I understand very much why they're protesting. I think that perhaps if people at least understood that there was a biological basis, it's not going anywhere. People care very much, and it's not going to go away because you pat them on the head and tell them that they should be happy because they're making enough. You know, we're going to give you a 5% raise, and that should make it all better. Because I think it would be impossible to do things equally. I mean, other species don't either. I like the idea of focusing on the process. I think that might be a really nice way to do it. We got a lot of equalizing to do if we're going to be focusing on giving people opportunity, because there's a whole lot of variability in how people, as you pointed out. But I like the idea of focusing on the process. I think that could help a lot, at least in the shorter term. And then maybe give us some ammunition for the longer term.
Okay, well, I think that's a good way, a good place to start coming to a close. So final question.
Sure.
All the research with primates and cucumbers and grapes and the rest of it, how has it shaped your outlook on our species?
That's an interesting question. I have children. I get asked a lot if it changed the way I viewed kids. I think both yes and no. I mean, in one respect, it made things seem, it makes me look at humans and realize that a lot of the things that we get worried about are just very natural behaviors. These are things we should be expecting. And it makes me understand that a lot of the things that people are worried about are also very natural behaviors, like the inequality in the world, that we care about these things because they are important, not just because we've been told that they're important by somebody or because we got upset by something we saw on social media, but because they really are actually deeply important to us and to our species. And I think it helps immensely to have more of a evolutionary background, understanding human behavior, tying us back into the animal kingdom. We aren't just, you know, that species that floats above the rest of the world, but we are tied into what everybody else does, which I think helps us both understand how we should think of ourselves as part of the world, part of the ecosystem, part of the rest of the environment, which is critically important in its own right, but also in thinking about how we got some of these behaviors. Why do we get here? Why do we care about these things? Which would help us potentially come up with better ideas for addressing them, and maybe righting some wrongs.
Professor Sarah Brosnan, thank you so much for your wonderful work and your time today.
Thank you. It's been fun.
So that was it today. Thank you, as always, for listening.
If you enjoy the On Humans podcast but feel like you could learn even more from it, like you sometimes forget things and would like to get back to it, either just to check some highlights or to dig deeper in understanding how different ideas in these episodes link to one another, you have now more ways to do so. You can read the On Humans newsletter now on Substack, and this will give you a lot of nice extra content in a written format. As a Patreon member, you can also get a lot of useful extras, from episode prefaces to Zoom calls with me. But that's it for now. Until next time, take care.